Just to make sure everybody is in the right room, this is how well do you really know your brewery chemicals? Just a little bit of housekeeping before we get this thing started. First off, just appreciate it if you can make sure your cell phones are muted for the presentation so they're not going off. The seminars throughout all these tracks, if you've downloaded the CBC app, you can scroll down on each individual seminar you attend. There's a little rate this seminar button. So we really appreciate it if you guys fill that out, take a couple minutes to do that after each seminar you attend. That kind of informs how our scheduling will go for the next year and gives us kind of some insight into what folks are taking well to during CBC and what they want to see in the future. There's going to be about 10 minutes or so of Q&A at the end, so we would just ask that you step to one of these mics in the aisles if you do have a question. That kind of helps give context since we do record all these and post them on the BA website afterwards. Otherwise, we've just got the speaker effectively answering questions that the listeners will have no idea about. I am Graham Rausch. I am the outreach and membership coordinator with the BA. So I'll be hanging out in the back of the room for a couple minutes afterwards. If anybody has questions about their membership, resources, anything like that, that's kind of my territory. Today's speaker is the Brewers Association Safety Ambassador. He's got a long, decades-long history in the beer industry and in dealing with safety issues for different businesses. He's also, I don't know if you guys have seen him around, but he is on all of these fantastic buttons that are going around. I've got about 10 on my shirt right now, and he's got a bag of them there. So if anybody wants some of those, you can come up to us after the seminar as well. So with that, I want to welcome Matt Stinchfield to the stage.
Thank you, everybody. I'm happy to see you're all here for this important subject. Well, just to outline where we're going on this, first of all, the focus is on the safety of chemical usage. It's not particularly about you should use this chemical versus that chemical and those sort of things. So focus here is on safety. I want to consider that you all know something. You all know what you know. So that's a positive going into this. You may also encounter some things that you don't know yet, and hopefully the light will turn on and you'll take some of those things with you. The major part of what we're talking about today is how chemical information about the hazards and properties and proper usage of chemicals is all around you in the brewery, and you may not have ever had anybody just sit and break it down for you and say, this actually is supposed to be this color, or this is what this number means, and those sort of things, and here's the real juicy stuff that's in an SDS. So I'm going to keep it as fun as I possibly can, other than, you know, do some chemical exercise up here and make pretty colored smoke, which I'm not going to do today, but I have done that. And we'll also focus on the sort of procedures and the equipment that we can use to stay safe when working with chemicals. So we're going to run the gamut of every sort of thought process down to a piece of equipment that is going to help you be safer. We're going to look at information and methods. I would the first thing here is substitution and elimination and safe work practices. These I call thoughts and actions, collectively these top two, thoughts and actions. How do we think about doing things in a particular manner that results in a safer workplace and safer for us? And these things also extend out into sustainability in terms of what sort of processes and chemicals are we using, and can we tune down the hazardous nature of those in any way? Then we're going to talk about engineering controls, which are the things, basically material equipment type things that we use to keep hazards away from us by arm's length. And I'll give you examples of those. We'll talk about administrative controls, which are those things which are written, you know, signs, labels, SDSs, training programs, company safety policies, all of that wonderful stuff that we can choose to ignore. Okay, I have a dry sense of humor, and if you hear me say something stupid like that, it's okay to, you know, get a little extra oxygen through laughter. And then we'll finish with personal protective equipment. These five, this list of five, this is the grand list, okay? And we'll come back to these through, this is the theme of the talk this morning. And then I'll finish up with focusing on a couple of examples of chemicals in the brewery, basically a discussion caustic and alkaline-based cleaners. And then we'll talk about carbon dioxide, which is, a chemical in the workplace that we often don't think of because it doesn't come in a barrel for most folks. So your gender may vary. I cleared this through the BA diversity authorities. This is, of course, Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. And imagine yourselves for just a moment as a bare naked person in a manufacturing environment with no protections whatsoever. And imagine that there's a hazard in the workplace and you're completely vulnerable and that hazard gets you. Now, if you're a paranoid like I am, a safety paranoid, you can even imagine that hazards have will. They have determination that they're out to get you. Here comes Joe today. Oh, it's his day for the slip in my slippery face. That's what I want to do. I want to take Joe out. If you want to take that approach, you can. But I say know your competitor. Know your enemy. Think of hazards in the workplace as challenges to be defeated. So how do we defeat that? What if we could cover ourselves with some sort of protective membrane? Personal protective equipment. Now when the hazard tries to get us, we've defeated it. Hopefully. What has to happen for us to be successful here? Well, we have to choose the right protective material for the chemical that, and we're talking chemical safety today, so I'll try to keep my focus in that direction. We try to choose a material that is effective against that chemical hazard, against its chemical properties. Would you wear a glove as a garment that is dissolved by the stuff you're working with? No. Open up a safety catalog sometime or, go on the internet and search for chemical protective gloves. Hundreds of kinds of gloves. Why? Because some gloves get dissolved by some substances, or they get cold and they get brittle, or you name it. Or they don't give you liquid protection, they only give you physical protection. And so there's no one glove fits all for all hazardous situations. So PPE is cool because, it's colorful and we can coordinate our outfits with it and, we can make other people wear it too, just like the buttons that Graham's wearing. No. So the whole idea here with PPE is to recognize that when it fails, and it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of ultimately when it fails, you get exposed because that's the last line of defense, right? After the PPE, all that hazard has to do is get to you. When the glove fails because it's got brittle or it's got a tear in it or it's the wrong glove, the next thing is your skin. And I love this. Years ago, I saw an advertisement for a glove manufacturer in a safety trade journal, and there was a hand cut out of a sponge. It was just a sponge in the shape of a hand. And the caption was, "To most chemicals, this is what you look like." And I always remembered that. And so PPE is not to be underestimated, especially with chemical safety. It is essential. But there are other types of controls that we can use. The next one we usually think of are administrative controls. So, for example, a sign in your chemical dispensing area that says, "Wear this PPE." Right? That's not really a PPE control. That's an administrative control, which is transmitting information to you. Or you have an SOP that says, when dispensing chemicals, this is how you do it to be safe. Okay? And just, administrative controls include things like in highway safety, road signs. And unfortunately, when we see it, say, 75, we make some sort of educated, in quotes, judgment that says, well, I probably can go 85 then. Because, they built in some margin of safety, right? So administrative controls are prone to our overriding. Oh, well, I know that's what they trained us, but gee whiz, I really like doing it this way. You've just lost the administrative control. You've lost the value of that. And so when you have SOPs and the SOP carries information about how to do something procedurally for quality reasons, and embedded in that are safety ideas about how to do it safely while you're doing it for quality or production reasons, then I feel like I'm a winner because you know, we slipped in some safety stuff into a document that you are going to follow because it's essential to you making your beer in the way that you want to make it every time. Then we have more of the hard materials and equipment that we call engineering controls, and we'll go through some examples of that. Things like a dike to keep the chemical from running out over the whole floor if you have a mishap where the chemicals are stored, or a secondary containment pallet that can contain liquid from a mishap. And then finally, the grand outer layer here, and this is where safety becomes sort of a Zen exercise, the thoughts and actions of safety, what we call safe work practices. And I'll tell you right now, for fair disclosure, that OSHA considers engineering controls, and this goes back to language that they developed in the early 70s, engineering controls are the be-all, end-all. And then safe work practices and administrative controls, they kind of roll together, and PPE they have at the bottom, justifiably so. But I know that we're not all able to go buy fancy machinery to do every kind of safety thing for us. We're going to be creative, and we're going to use thoughts and actions because essentially they're free. I do want to remind you, though, Voltaire, the French philosopher, said common sense is altogether uncommon. And when we talk about safe work practices, that's really what we're talking about, is like, don't be an idiot. So all of these things together come in two flavors, prevention and protection. And without me going into my, you know, safe sex talk, because I don't have time today, because it always gets out of hand. There are two kinds of safety out there, prevention and protection. If we think about safe sex as being, what are the hazards of sex? Well, an unwanted pregnancy or a disease. So how do we prevent that? We don't do it. Well, that's not satisfying enough for most people, right? I mean, how do you make beer without using chemicals? I don't know. Go to Borneo and make it out of a hollowed out tree with some kind of starchy fruit. That's about as good as it's going to get if you want to make beer without chemicals. So we're going to have chemicals, and since we can't completely eliminate their use, then we're going to have to resort to the sort of the B plan, which is protection. We protect our physical body, we protect the equipment, we use compatible pumps in strong chemicals, and those sort of things, and we act in a way that's appropriate for what we're doing, and we don't write off chemicals, you know. I used to do all kinds of hazardous material safety training, and among them were hazmat truck drivers. The guys that drive the trucks with all the diamond-shaped placards on the side, they don't even wear seat belts. Well, you know, hey, man, you know, I'm like, no, I don't know. Don't be an idiot. What I'd like to do, if we are successful in our short time together today, is I want you to take these, what are called hazard controls, the outer limits here, safe work practices and substitution and elimination, then engineering controls, administrative controls, and personal protective equipment. I want you to take all those and distill it down into new tools into your toolbox, and I want you to go home with that toolbox in your mind. Now we're going to go down through those orbits from the outside to the inside. We'll finish with PPE. Substitution and elimination, and here's just a few examples of how you might do it in a brewery. We're talking about changing a process to use a less toxic chemical, for example, and it might not be done for safety. You might be doing it for environmental reasons. But for example, using a lower concentration PAA, so you've got safer oxidizer and flammability hazards. You've lowered those now to where they're not just so right on the edge, right? There are PAA products that are 31 or more percent hydrogen peroxide, and you pretty much need a hazmat suit to dispense that stuff and some very special pumps that don't the seals don't decay very quickly. Can you go to a 20%, 15%, there are 5% products in the market, and at some point you're going to go, hey man, I'm using the 5% stuff, I feel safe. But, and don't do this at home, folks, don't put your hands in 5% and think it's safer than 15%. Anybody here who's ever gotten a little drop splashed on an exposed part of skin from PAA knows the reaction is quite quick. And I mean reaction because it's doing a chemical reaction on your tissue. How about acid cleaning under CO2 as an alternative to caustic cleaning? What are we doing there? Well, in addition to not spending as much on CO2, so we're being thoughtful that way. I mean, what if it turns out that craft beer is responsible for global warming for all the CO2 we let out? You know, but at the other hand, we're reducing the possibility for vacuum implosion of a vessel because we made a valving error, and we combined hot caustic with a CO2 atmosphere. Right? Do you know that can crumple your tank like a beer can? What if we look at a lower pH solid oxidizing cleaner? I'm not going to mention trade names. You all know who they are. Versus a sodium hydroxide concentrate, liquid concentrate. Is it right for you? I'm not here to tell you that. That's not what this talk is about. This is an example of a substitution. And how about adding surfactant to your kettle so you reduce the chance of boil over? That's not even a chemical hazard. That's a thermal burn hazard. I talked about that yesterday and showed gory pictures. Okay? But this is a substitution, and it reduces a hazard. Or eliminating it altogether. Let's say you're using DE as a filter aid, and you know you're set up for that type of filtering. Number one, if you are, look very closely at your supplier's technical data and make sure it does not have crystalline silica in it. Crystalline silica has a new OSHA standard, and it causes silicosis, a fatal disease of the lungs. And you guys all have beards, so you can't wear the respirators to solve that problem. So, you know, where are we going to go with this? Well, there are centrifuges. There are lenticular filters. There are, you know, hey, we're going to go Cascale. We're just going to go Commando, no filtering at all. Okay? Your choice. And how about carbon monoxide? You say, well, we're going to get rid of our propane forklift so that we don't have carbon monoxide. And by the way, direct fire kettles also have this risk. Carbon monoxide accumulating in the workplace. We're going to use an electric one. But did you know when you charge an electric forklift, it produces hydrogen gas, which is released into the workspace? Now, it's going to take a lot of hydrogen in a kind of a tight space, but I don't know where you charge your forklift. Maybe it's in a closet somewhere or in your boiler room. And if that's the case, you can accumulate hydrogen and your boiler goes on and, you know, Bob's your uncle. So some simple things to think about. I'm not going to go, you know, I'm going to be general here. Housekeeping. If we're talking about chemical safety housekeeping, keep the labels from having the goop on them. I mean, I always used to tell this to guys who use paints and lacquers, you know. You dribble the stuff all on the outside of the barrel. Now you can't read the label. Don't be an idiot. Putting equipment away. Very simple stuff, right? This is the physical hazard of slips, trips, and falls, and we don't need to make that any worse. And your walking and working surfaces and your exit of the building in case you have to in a hurry. First of all, you want to avoid spills. Keep your housekeeping orderly. You know, we've all seen it, right? Medusa's head of jungle of transfer hoses and power supplies to transfer pumps and slippery wet surfaces. And, you know, you talk to people who've had an injury in the cellar, and quite often you'll find out it was in the middle of that kind of shitstorm of activity. Put that stuff away, keep it organized, count that into part of your time to do the activity is to put things away correctly. And then there's no substitute for a drill. In high school, my soccer coach, you know, 4 days of drill, if we did that really well and stuck to it, we might get to play a scrimmage on Friday. You can't do that to a high school kid. That's horrible. We want to play soccer. No, drill, 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 drill. But I know many, many specific examples of where drills were used, and when the day came, it made all the difference in the world. And don't forget to wash your hands and wash your PPE. You use the PPE to create a barrier between a hazardous chemical and you. And then you slough off the gloves and you leave them somewhere. That stuff gets on that surface. Your beaker that you dispense to make your working solution, you know, you didn't take that and immediately rinse it. What color are most of the chemicals we use? Clear. They look like water. Maybe a little thicker, but at a distance, they just look like a wet surface. And somewhere in the back of our mind, we only think wet surfaces are water. Not me. I see a puddle and I think it's a chemical, but that's just me. And maybe that's the kind of mentality that you can kind of work into. Wash your PPE and put it away promptly. The longer you leave the chemical in contact with the PPE, the shorter the lifetime of the PPE. Now you're buying more gloves. And you know what? How do you know the glove is bad? Because it failed while you were wearing it, and suddenly your hand's itching and burning, and whoa. Okay? So, you know, you can beat that by just being proactive and being hygienic. Okay, so that's what I've got on the sort of thoughts and actions idea. Let's go to engineering controls. Engineering controls, to use a gender term, are ways that we manhandle contaminants or hazards in the workplace. We control it, we divert it, we collect it and consolidate it, you know, those sort of things. And we use devices and machinery for that. So here's some common ones, not just necessarily limited to chemical safety. Machine guarding, packaging lines, right? Gears, belts, pulleys, all that stuff, keeping that guarded. Your malt mill system and your pickup for your malt conveyance. Using proper electrical disconnects, ventilation systems. That definitely comes into place if we're talking about dust accumulation in certain brewery activities. Pressure relief and vacuum relief valves on brewery vessels. Foam sensor on a kettle. Okay, these are all, you see how they're all devices? They're all things. We go buy these things. We specify them for that hazard control job, and we buy it. Now, if you are in the process of just designing a brewery right now, there's no time like the present. You know, you're going to have this big ask of your bank or your investors. You know, we need X dollars. You know. Make sure that you've got these things considered in the process of starting it up, because otherwise you're kind of chasing it afterwards, trying to find out what those engineering controls should be and how to add them in later. And then there are these sort of passive controls, which don't actually control anything, but they give you some other form of information that's very relevant about the hazard. And obviously temperature and pressure gauges are a couple of these. A carbon dioxide monitor. It's not changing the level of carbon dioxide in the space. It's telling you what the concentration is. Then it gives you the information that you can use to go figure out a way to control it or divert it or, you know, ventilate it or capture it or even change your fermenter cleaning process so that you're not releasing as much when you turn over a tank. A forklift horn, right? It doesn't mean you're not going to get run over by a forklift. You still have to move out of the way. But the forklift operator is using this method of communicating the hazard. Process controls, okay? Now, more and more breweries, even for small brewery designs, are having a lot of automation on them. This automation is, you know, it's kind of like the ghost in the machine, right? Do you really know that it's controlling the hazards that you think it is when it closes a valve? And has it been programmed in a way that is not just about making beer, but is about protecting the operators? And those two aren't necessarily aligned in all cases. Machine guarding, enclosing chemical transfer lines, that's certainly a good one. And then we'll look at some examples here. Specific to chemicals, secondary containment for chemical storage. It's passive, it sits there, but you got to use it, right? But if you use it, someday it's going to be saving you and you'll be glad you had it. I'm showing you this picture for two reasons, and one of them is that these are some strong reactive chemicals that are used in a brewery, and these are the right kind of pumps. Right, that have seals that won't be degraded by oxidizing sanitizers and so forth. The other reason I'm showing this to you is that the individual in the picture has short sleeve shirts, no gloves, no eye protection, and his pant legs are in his boots. Okay? Because I'm not talking about PPE. I use this picture on purpose because I want to drive your attention to the equipment choice that's the engineering control. We're going to get to PPE in just a minute. And then, of course, things like ventilation for moving CO2 around, diluting it, removing it, and so forth, and the monitoring devices that are necessary so that we know we're being effective at that. Okay, now we're going to start seeing more and more slides because as we get down towards the inside of those spheres, we're getting to where, you know, nothing really works 100%. You know, when there's a puddle on the floor and I don't step in it, I walk around it. I've used thoughts and actions, and I've completely avoided the hazard at that moment. Now, if I just leave it there, I'm leaving the hazard for somebody else. But if I don't step in it, I can't be affected by it. Winner, winner. If I go to administrative controls and I have a sign that says don't step in the wet areas, and you just go, well, crap, half my brewery is wet area. Well, you know, see how it's not as effective. It's up to you to ignore it or appreciate what the information is. So these are the kind of things that in chemical safety originate in the SDS. Having an SDS binder available in the workplace up to date and inclusive of all the chemicals in your business is not for OSHA compliance. It is essential technical information to be a brewer and to be a safe brewer. So don't fight it. It doesn't have to be a $200 binder from some printing company. Go down to your big box office supply store, drop $4 on a 3-inch binder, and start putting the SDSs in there. That's all it takes. OSHA is not specific about how you get compliant, but they say that the SDSs have to be complete, up to date, and available in the workplace. And they're the basis for a lot of other things that brewers need to be doing, which is using the chemicals correctly, avoiding incompatibilities with other chemicals that we have in the brewery, wearing the correct PPE. If there's a disposal or spill question, these are all answered in the SDS. So we're going to start at the SDS level, and I'm not going to sit here and go through all 16 sections and drive you nutty. What I am going to say is that the top four sections, there's 16 sections in a standard SDS, and the top four, go, you know, sit down over your coffee break sometime and just thumb through. It sounds nerdy, but you know what? You might learn something. Look through there and go, oh, I didn't know that there was this other stuff in our caustic. What's this, you know, ethylene glycolate stuff or whatever? You know, understand that, you know, you may not know as much as you think you know, and the SDS is going to give you the composition in Section 3, and it's going to give you a summary statement in Section 2 of the hazards of the stuff. And it's going to talk about first aid in Section 4, right? At least know that this stuff is there. And then the other one I put a little love heart beside is Section 8, personal protective equipment. Who should know what PPE is best other than the people that make the stuff and package it at a concentrated level and have a whole, you know, manufacturing process just to make your chemical? Now, there was a time that SDSs were, you know, all lawyered up. And that is those days are pretty much gone. You're going to find the SDS is really thorough supply of information. First four sections and Section 8 for PPE. They're no good if you aren't familiar with them, so at least read through them. Make sure that you're current with them. When there's an SDS that you're missing, you've got to find it. So contact your chemical supplier and say, hey, we don't have one for, you know, XYZ. Okay, right. I'll email it right over to you. Right? You're their customer, and it's their legal obligation to provide it for you. And if you don't understand what's on something, what's on an SDS, ask. Find if maybe there's a chemically minded or chemically trained individual in your group. Say, what is this vapor pressure thing? I don't know what that means. Can you help me out? So you know, don't operate in a vacuum. Ask for help. You have to do training on the SDS. So what that means is any individual who's using that chemical has to have been given training that's appropriate for the use of that chemical. Now, if you were using phosgene gas because you're an anarchist but working in a proper manufacturing facility, you know, this stuff, you know, they say it smells like freshly mowed grass just before they die, right? It's that hazardous. I worked with this stuff before. And, you know, some really scary stuff. To me, brewing chemistry is like, you know, it's okay. It's okay. I don't fear for my life. But, you know, you have to have training that's appropriate for that. So for phosgene gas, you know, it's moon suits and SCBAs and specialized equipment. But for a caustic chemical, it's this kind of personal protective equipment. It's slippery. If it's spilled, don't spill it. Don't leave residues around for people who don't have personal protective equipment, who don't know what you're doing, right? Does your tour guide come through and set out the first beer samples on top of the barrel of caustic? You know, I can imagine it. I can totally imagine it. And keep those updated. Keep the binder where people know how to get to it. Now we're gonna go to the shorthand thing from SDSs. We take the SDS and we distill it down to six information components. Number one, and this is, by the way, in 2012, we underwent our OSHA rules on chemical safety, underwent a harmonization with other developed nations around the world. So, you know, if you go to Czech Republic right now, you may not know how to read caustic 50% solution, but you can see pictograms that have a test tube pouring a corrosive chemical on a guy's hand. So, you know, we kind of tried to get around the whole language thing. And a lot of the global harmonized safety stuff we already had going here in the U.S. since the 1980s, 1983 to be specific. So, but first thing is there's a signal word, and there's two choices of signal word. Danger, which is worse than warning, which is some hazard. Danger, more hazard. Boom. The pictograms, and you can have, you know, one or, I mean, conceivably you could have, you know, eight or nine of them. And they depict the type of hazard graphically. You have very simple information that is extracted from Chapter 1 of the SDS. Who makes it? Where are they? How do I contact them? And then two sections that have little codes. You'll see, you know, P013. You're like, what's that? Those are codes that translate to a longer description of, say, precautionary or first aid things that come from the SDS. So the label is a shorthand. It's abridged SDS. Same with the health and safety hazards. You know, can cause asphyxiation, can cause intoxication, can cause problems breathing, various things like that. And then any other product identifiers, usually it's the trade name of the product. Because most things that we use aren't, you know, that somebody's slapped a cutesy name on it, and that's how we refer to it. You know, the quad, the whatever, you know, the, again, I'm just going to try to stay away from trade names. Now, long before the global harmonized labeling system, we were using these other labeling systems. This one was developed in Canada. It was called the HMIS. But interestingly, this color coding that we're going to see repeat as we go forward, blue for health, red for flammability, yellow for reactivity or oxidizing potential. How well does it play with other chemicals, essentially? And then a white area. And in the HMIS, they use a personal protective code. So a certain chemical would have numbers from 0 to 4 in the top three circles here. And then in the personal protection, it would have a letter, and the letter corresponds to these pictograms on the right. Okay, so let's see. For dispensing caustic from the barrel, I would probably have D, but I would also wear safety glasses under my face shield, right? Face shield only protects frontal onslaught. There was a guy in college that dropped a jug of nitric acid, and he was wearing a face shield and an apron. But his reaction as he saw it going towards the floor was this: get away. The splash came up and got him in the chin. This relates to beer, believe it or not. He goes to the hospital at the clinic at the college, and the doctor says, we're going to have to put you in a shower for several hours and just let it gently rinse because we don't want to scrub it. You know, we just let it gently rinse. So they stripped him down. They put him in a chair in the shower, and the doctor comes back after a while, and he goes, how you doing, man? He goes, this is boring as hell. Well, can I do anything for you? I'd love to have a beer. Doctor goes and gets him a beer. Those were the days. Anyways, know what your PPE can and can't do, and sometimes you have to just watch the chemical hit the floor if that's the way your PPE is, strange as it seems. Okay, and then we're going to talk about signs, and signs are much more specific than you think they are, right? Because you can go on the internet to any one of these sign-making companies, and you can make it say danger, caution, hazard, warning, notice, whatever you want to say with whatever colors and put whatever message on there. I want to educate you, if I can today, that these are actually quite specific. There are three OSHA signs, and these are the kind of signs that you would see on a wall or a piece of equipment in a brewery. It's entirely up to you to decide where to put those, and you decide based on your perception of a hazard in the area. And you're going to do that because you're being thoughtful about, how do I do all my cellar work here? Oh, well, I do this, I do that, I do this other thing. And what hazards befall me? Well, you know, there's working at heights if I'm dry hopping from a ladder. There's, you know, there's the chemical safety. There's the confined space because I've got CO2 in the vessel. So, okay, I've identified a few hazards. So now I'm going to make a notice about those hazards. And I'm going to be hopefully I'm going to follow this sort of format. So the lowest level warning sign here is called a caution sign, and it's a black on yellow color convention, and it's used when there's a moderate to minor injury potential. This is not usually life-threatening. You wouldn't use caution for a life-threatening thing, right? You wouldn't say, caution, don't go in this confined space because you might asphyxiate yourself. That would be not minor. Next one up, for death or serious injury is possible. Not probable, but, you know, it could happen if you, you know, the right things came together. And that will say warning, and it will be on an orange panel. And then the third, the worst deal here is danger. And that's where death or serious injury is predicted. Okay, so you'll see this on confined space signage, and you'll see it on high voltage signage, particularly. Those are two. Black and red on a white background. So, as I'm saying, these are not random. And if you're going to use them, it's helpful if you're consistent with them and you train your coworkers on this is what these mean. And also, if you have a case where an emergency responder is running into your building for some reason, they know what these things mean, and they're you know, it's almost a direct channel to the cerebellum. They're going to know exactly what they should be doing. And there are a few more here. The blue notice sign, it's just providing some general information. It's not about a hazard. You know, it's you might say, notice, eye protection is necessary in this area. And then we have these others, just the sort of safety language, and those have a green panel on them. And that might be just something like, you know, as this one shows. And then for fire and electrical safety, usually red is involved, but they don't necessarily tell us exactly a particular format that's required. Okay, so think about this. Here's red used here in fire and electricity, and on the four colored one I just showed you a minute ago that goes blue, red, yellow, white, well, red is flammability. So we're, you know, there's some link up, right? And if you're driving down the highway and you see a sign on the road that has a big white H on it for a hospital, what background is the panel? What, blue, right? So we know blue is health. We already know this. I'm just trying to point it out for you. Blue is health, red is flammable stuff and electrical stuff, yellow is reactivity. If you've ever looked at that PAA labeling, you've seen that yellow diamond on there, says oxidizer 5.1 or 5.2. We'll get there just next. And then finally, placards. Placards are not labels. Labels are on the container. Placards are not signs. Signs are in the workplace to direct the action. Placards are in two places. This first one with the four diamonds is on your building entrances. That's the most important place for them. You can use them internally on the walls and so forth, but it's on the entrance, and this code tells the fireman who's running in there to save you exactly what sort of hazards, serious health hazards. The max is four here. This one shows serious health hazards, no ignitable hazards, some reactive chemicals, and don't put water on it or it could explode. Now, that's important to tell to a fireman because their main line of defense is using water against things. So that information is critical, but it's in a code, and I wanted to break the code for you today. The other one here is a DOT. We'll get to that momentarily. So as I mentioned, for each of these colors, there's a 0 to 4 standard. A 0 health hazard, you know, that's like coffee. We recognize there's a health hazard if you have extreme overconsumption. But it's not, it doesn't rate. Okay, up to 4 can be lethal. That poison gas I was talking about, you know, that would be a 4. Flammability, flammable gases like propane are automatically a 4. So if you've got propane tankage because of your pilot system or because of your forklift, your back door should have a 4 on the red. And yellow, look at this. Number 4, may explode at normal temperatures and pressures. What the hell is that stuff? Right? You look at it funny, and it goes. I'll tell you what, the stuff that's inside an airbag, that chemical, would get a 4 here. Right? You know, you touch them, and they go off. But we often see 1s and 2s here in breweries because 2 would be violent chemical change at high temperatures or pressures. Right? If you heat up oxidizers, they get very unfriendly in a fire. they get really, really, they like morph into, you know, Dr. Jekyll chemicals. So that's good to know. And then there's a number of different, mostly letter codes here that are used in the white that can emphasize specific hazards. So we might see an OX, O-X, at a brewery because we're using oxidizing sanitizers. So what is this deal? You're the fireman. You come in running to the brewery, and, you know, some brewer who didn't understand the code said, well, you know, I'm going to put 444 and a W on there. So immediate health hazard, could die, flammable gases, explosive chemicals, and don't put water on it or the whole thing goes. Firemen actually have a name for this. It's called a BBLC, right? And I did years of hazmat response and, you know, responded to a couple of BBLCs. They're pretty fun. Beer binoculars and a lawn chair. Now, these that you've seen as container labels, they're expressing the hazard of the chemical on a container, but they derive from Department of Transportation rules. And this is the variety of them. I'm showing you the whole thing so I can express to you that explosives here, it goes left side is most hazardous to right side is least hazardous. How does radioactive get almost to the most least hazardous thing? And how come, we know how come explosives are there. So this paradigm was designed by Department of Transportation. I like to think of it as how big of a crater does it leave during a truck accident? Okay, it's a measurement of acute hazard, which means the immediate effects, as opposed to chronic hazards like number 9. That's what they put on hazardous waste that has PCBs in it. It looks like dirty dirt to me. You can go play in it. 20 years later, you get liver disease. So DOT is not about chronic toxicity or environmental pollution. They're about how critical is it in a transportation incident. Just understand that going into it, all right? So which chemicals are we using in a brewery? We're using flammable gases, and we've got nitrogen and CO2, non-flammable gases. We're oxygenating our wort with a cylinder of oxygen. We're right up there as in terms of how big of a, you know, an event can it create. And then we're using oxidizers. And we're using corrosive. So we kind of run the gamut there. So as a review, and an example I'm giving you here is for peracetic acid, and I'm, you know, kind of cobbled together different bits of information from different manufacturers, so none of this is, exact. So you've got the SDS, and it's up to date, and it's available, and you guys have read it, and you've trained on the right methods to protect yourselves. You've got a label that has all six of those tick boxes ticked. It's got danger or warning signal word. It's got the pictograms identified here are corrosive and flammable and oxidizer. You know, acetic acid in a high enough concentration releases a flammable vapor. You just think it smells like pickles, but it actually gives off a vapor which in a confined space or in an enclosed area could ignite. And then you've got signs in the workplace of various natures that talk about how we're going to be safe with working with that chemical in that area. And then we've got the placards. So this is the placard that would be just for the PAA product, 3 of health hazard. And we're talking not a working solution, the straight stuff. 1 for ignitability, slightly ignitable, slightly reactive, oxidizer capability, and then the DOT hazards that come with it. So that's, if you look at that, that's kind of all weird coded, color-coded numerical code, and that's what I wanted to convey to you today. Now we're going to go on to the fancy stuff. But number one, as I mentioned earlier, PPE is not fail-safe. It's your last line of defense, and these are some of the reasons that people get hurt when they think PPE's got their back. They didn't make the correct selection, the right compatible material for the stuff that they're doing, or, for example, you know, love those little nitrile disposables, right? They're great when you're in working solution in the cellar and, you know, you're sanitizing fittings before you put them together. That's not really how you should be dispensing the hard stuff when you're making up the working solution, right? You should have those big, long, pale green nitrile gloves that are heavy duty, right? Because they give you some physical structure that the thin nitrile glove doesn't give you, and so forth. That's all in selection. And how do you use it? Do you clean it and put it away so that it lasts for the next time and have you checked it out? The worst way to find out your glove is leaking is when your hand starts to tell you so. The best way is to periodically look at it and see, is it yellowed? Has it changed its shape or its elasticity? Has it become brittle? And if so, it's gone, replace it. And we're going to just quickly go through all of these things that if you think about the routes of entry for chemicals to expose us, the highest level is respiratory, right? We can only live a couple of minutes without the right air. The next one is going to be dermal absorption. Your skin is about 2 square meters of surface area. That's a lot of possible contact for things that attack the skin or move through the skin. And then the third route of entry is ingestion. And, of course, you're not eating your chemicals, right? But for that person who's putting their sample glasses on top of the chemical drum or, you know, using a dirty glove to pick up a clean thing and then getting the dirty, the chemical on the thing, then, you know, that's how things get transferred. So we're going to look at these protective devices for these parts of the body. First of all, indirect vented goggles. These are good. Have you got your BA goggles yet? If you came by and saw us at boot camp, you would have a pair of them. We've got BA logo glasses we were giving out. But for chemical splash protection, you're going to want either an indirect vented goggle, like second down on the left column, or a flip down face shield. The chemical goggles, people complain about those because they're prone to fogging up. You can, scuba divers have anti-foam stuff. You can spit on it and rub that on the inside. I mean, there are ways of, you know, just to be frank about it. Here's the gloves, and I mentioned, you know, for low hazard use, the nitrile disposables are the thing to use. For a moderate hazard use, like things that happen in packaging and some cellar work, you can get away with a hybrid glove. It usually has something like a stretchy synthetic under layer and then nitrile or neoprene on the outside. It's a laminated glove. So you get some, you know, good chemical protection, but good physical protection because it's stretchy. And then the hardcore stuff for your concentrated brewing chemicals, I would recommend mostly these nitrile gloves. A lot of nitrile gloves made by a lot of different manufacturers are this aqua color, but there's no system like there is with signage. So you could have an aqua glove that's made of a different chemical protective material and might not work for corrosives. So every glove manufacturer will have a compatibility chart. You look up your chemicals. Where do you find out your chemical list? You go back to your SDS binder. You figure out your chemicals. Then you look in the checkbox and you go, okay, that's rated good for caustic soda. And I can't overemphasize the importance of proper footwear. And we're talking chemical safety here, so we're talking about PVC generally. PVC is not an awesome chemical protective material. So why make boots out of it? Because you need a lot of protective material for a boot. So they just make it really thick. And PVC is a super cheap plastic. So that's why. Yes, you can get the hazmat boots that are made of special chemical protective rubbers, but you know, you're looking at hundreds of dollars for a pair of chemical boots. So you can, as simple as going to a big box discount store for 15 or 20 bucks, you can buy thick PVC, you know, shin-high boots like this with a reinforced toe. That should be the basic minimum. And of course, the pant leg goes over the boot for splash reduction if you get splashed. And then all sorts of other things like aprons and hearing protection and fall protection. So they, you know, PPE is a pretty big class. I'm not going to spend time on respiratory protection today except to say this. The only respirator that you should be using in your brewery, and it should be done on a voluntary basis, is a disposable dust mask, the paper, white paper looking material. And if you've got a beard, it's not even effective. So in this case, you want to just go to engineering controls. You want to use ventilation. You want to use good housekeeping to get your dust after your milling process, get that picked up, and don't let it get tracked around and accumulated and blown around and so forth. So there are other ways to protect the lungs than respirators. I'm saying this because respiratory protection programs are a giant wormhole of compliance issues. You have to send workers to a clinic and have their respiratory systems tested and so on. There are numerical ratings on the respirators, and it's a big deal, and you have to have a written program. So in summary here, you've got safe work practices, the thoughts and actions and hygiene that you're going to use, your engineering controls, which might be in electronic systems or mechanical devices that protect you, administrative controls, labels, signs, placards, and your personal protective equipment. So those are the tools that go in your toolbox. You mix and match according to what you perceive the hazard to be. Nobody's going to tell you for this thing it has to be exactly this way. Unfortunately, that's up to your own self-determination. Use a combination of affordable methods from all four of these to be safe. Real quickly here, you know what chemicals you've got in your workplace. I'm just going to flash these before you so we have time for a few questions. Don't forget that you've got hazardous gases in the workplace, and you may have created them or you may use them. They're nice and fine when they're confined into a cylinder, but they accumulate into a breathing space, not so good. I'll give you an example with carbon dioxide momentarily. Flammables, alcohols that you're using in the lab or for fittings, propane and natural gas on your boiler, and other chemicals that come with the rest of your operation, so kitchen, janitorial, pest control, and so on. So here's an example for a liquid caustic solution. And what I'm doing is I'm just throwing up some of the coded information that you should have for this. And by now, I hope you can read it and understand it. Health hazard is 2. Is that something I should worry about avoiding? Yes. It will cause an injury. Flammability is 0. Okay. I can smoke while I'm around it. Why not? Because you're touching it, and then you put the cigarette to your mouth, and now you've ingested it. Reactivity is 2. Okay, doesn't play well with other chemicals. Personal protection, this is what's recommended. That's pretty gnarly. Respirator, apron, rubber, and you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that's what comes with the concentrated caustic solution in the barrel. On the other hand, I might be considering substituting it with an alkaline powder product. And notice the pH, they have the same warning word, but we're now the pH is a little more modest. Well, you know, you change pH by one whole unit, that's 10 times difference in pH. So there's that. You have to decide if it's the right product for you, but the health is better, the reactivity is less, personal protection is easier to do, but now you're dealing with a powder, so your chance of generating dust while you're handling it is an issue. You've got to consider that. And when in either case, when these solutions are made up to working solution, they basically come out to the same thing in the end. So your question is, you know, do I deal with the fact that my liquid caustic is super gnarly to begin with and just make sure I'm doing it right? Or do I start with something that's a little less hazardous? In either case, I end up with something that's a pretty corrosive liquid that I still have to have some personal protection for. So that's what I'm suggesting you do, is make these considerations. And then finally, we'll just look at carbon dioxide. Look at this, an asphyxiant that can kill you, and instead of saying danger, it says warning. Why? Because it comes in a container that's pretty safe. They're not thinking, right? You don't get an SDS for carbon dioxide your beer made. You get an SDS for the cylinder you buy from your gas supplier. So that, you know, just saying be watchful about these things. Health hazard of 1. Wait, can't I suffocate when I'm overexposed to it? You know, oh, I need safety glasses and gloves. Why gloves? Because when CO2 is expanding rapidly coming out of its cylinder, it gets very, very cold. That's all that is. It's colorless, it's odorless, it has a poor warning property, meaning, you know, phosgene at least smells like freshly mowed grass and you can run away if you know what it, you know. Arsine, they say, smells like garlic, and then you drop dead. So those are not good warning properties, right? Ammonia has a pretty good warning property. Oh, man, is that irritating. I'm out of here. And you can usually get away to safety. Carbon dioxide, you don't smell it. You don't know it. It's right there. And it's 50% more dense than air. So we have this belief that it's all, you know, it all goes down to the floor. I'll show you a diagram real fast, and then we'll finish up. But here's ambient air is currently at a 300,000-year high on the planet. We're at about 400, 405 parts per million ambient average around the planet. The permissible exposure limit for all day long without any respiratory protection is 5,000 parts per million. How are you going to know what the carbon dioxide concentration in your packaging line area is? You've got to go and pony up for one of those monitors. They're getting very affordable. They're under $1,000 now. The little handheld dealy, and you just hold it at a point, you know, hold it where you're breathing. That, you know, what am I getting? Don't exhale into it. You'll get the wrong number from the CO2 you just expired. And so on. The first symptoms come at about 1.5% oxygen, and IDLH comes at 4%. IDLH is a technical term that is immediately detrimental to life or health. But I'd like you to remember it as, I don't like it here. Okay? At 4%, it's not that the CO2 is toxic, it's that at 4%, it's displaced enough oxygen in the breathing space that you don't have enough oxygen left. Whenever one gas comes into a space and occupies it, oxygen is the loser. So you always have two hazards. When you have carbon dioxide built up, you also have oxygen deficiency. And here's this great drawing I found, and this is based on, you know, actually making measurements, that right near the source, the CO2 hasn't yet tumbled down. And it's not going to fully tumble down onto the floor in a busy area of activity. It's only 50% heavier than air. It's going to be pretty much wherever you are. Worse on the floor, worse on a cellar bottom of a staircase, worse in an enclosed packaging, cold room. Some places we can encounter it, obviously during fermentation, during the testing work that we're doing. Here's somebody doing a CO2 test on a batch of beer. This is a serious point of exposure for CO2 in breweries. I've seen numbers up to 3%. Okay, 4% was I don't like it here. 30,000 parts per million. And, you know, we have a loose fitting in a closed area like this. We can certainly accumulate CO2, and there have been fatalities. So, understand how the codes work. Read the information based on the SDSs, and it goes out from there. Understand that things might be mislabeled, and it might not be your fault, but recognize those. The whole chain of events of information, from SDS to labels to signs and placards on the walls and doors. And make sure that you've got good engineering controls. You've thought that through and put into place what you can afford and operate. And keep your PPE in good shape. And that's what I've got. Graham, do we have 1 or 2 minutes? Okay. So if you've got a question, you want to step up to the mic, that would be super. If you have a question that involves self-embarrassment because of something you did to yourself, I'll be around for a few minutes and we can have safety confessional one-on-one. How's that? Thank you very much for your attention today, folks.